his lecture series on quantum matter and topological quantum computing. And yes, please.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming. I know 9 a.m. is also very kind of early. It's early for me as well, so thanks for coming. Yeah. So I just want to follow up about the lecture yesterday. So yesterday we introduced some basic notion about the Z2 topological order, right? Using the Turing code as a very simple example. And I don't want to go into much details about other things, but just want to mention that given the Z2 Turing code, there are some simple generalization where you can generalize the gauge group, the Z2, to arbitrary discrete finite group. So that is called a Kitai quantum double model. So it's a subject you may want to understand or if you are interested in. And more generally, you can also extend the idea of the quantum double model to the more general Levin-Wen SuNet model. So there, the model doesn't rely on there's a gauge group, but instead, the input data will be some so-called fusion category. So there, you don't need to have a gauge group to begin with. So that is a more general notion for the topological quantum order. Yeah, but I won't go into any details about this low subject. Yeah. So today, there are two goals I want to achieve here. So the first goal is I want to introduce topological order as some kind of a generalized symmetry breaking order state. And in addition to that, I want to introduce the entanglement structure, in particular, how should we use the entanglement structure to understand this long-range entangled, non-trivial states of matter. So this is the slogan here. So a very useful reference is by John McGreevy from UC San Diego. So this is a recent archive reference. So there you can find a very nice review about this subject. Yeah. So I guess the motivation is basically, you may heard that, so Landau, Ginzburg paradigm has been very nice because you can classify different phases of matter, depends on whether you break the symmetry or not, right? You can distinguish in the Ising model where there's a trivial phase, you don't break the global Z2 symmetry, and you can get the older phase if you spontaneously break the global symmetry, right? So it's a natural question to ask, when we talk about topological order, then how should we understand this symmetry breaking paradigm by Landau, right? So as it turns out, if you can generalize the notion for the symmetry, then you can understand topological quantum order as some kind of symmetry breaking order state. So that is my goal today. Yeah. So for this goal, let us recall what does it mean by symmetry breaking for the conventional Ising model. Yeah, so I just write down SSB, so this means spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, so say you consider some 2D lattice. And on every side of the lattice, you put a qubit, spin 1/2, on the vertices. Yeah. And this is the Hamiltonian. So they have two terms. The first term is the familiar Ising interactions. So by this bracket, I mean the neighboring site, ij. So for example, the zz coupling could be this guy and this guy. Yeah, so you basically sum over all the possible link, and you couple this the neighboring spin using this zz Ising interactions. And another term is minus g. And then you sum over every single site using the on-site Pauli X operator. So this is a quantum model because as you can see here, these two terms don't commute. So there are something interesting can going on in the ground state. So there's a global Z2 symmetry for this Hamiltonian, right? We know the symmetry is generated by the product of x, right? Because that operator commute with this term and this term. So basically, when you consider this action, right, if you start from the sum product state in the z basis, you just do the global spin flip. And as you can see here, the zz intersection means that if you flip the spin, if you flip all the spins, so you flip the z to minus z for every spin. So this term, the first term is invariant, and that term will commute with this poly x operator. So that is a symmetry. And at least there are two limits we know, right? We know what happens. If you consider g to be zero, then you go back to some classical model. So this term is zero. And what is the ground state? So when you consider g to be zero, in order to get a ground state, you need to set the neighboring, it should be ZIHZJ. Yeah, the neighboring ij, the zz, the product of these two product of these two poly z should be one, right? So that you can minimize the energy. So that gives you the ground state. And there are twofold degeneracy. One possibility is you can choose every spin to be pointed up, and that satisfies the product of z to be one, right? And the second possibility is you choose every spin to be pointing down, and again, because they all align with each other, so you minimize the energy. And in particular, one thing you notice that is that even though the Hamiltonian satisfy this global Z2 symmetry, but the ground state is not. In particular, this global spin down state is equal to the global symmetry generator acting on the spin up state, right? Yeah. So in other words, the ground states will spontaneously break the global Z2 symmetry in the sense that even though Hamiltonian satisfy this symmetry, but the ground state is not, when you start from some ground state, you apply this global symmetry generator, you get a different ground state, right? So ground state itself is not invariant under this global Z2 symmetry. So that's what we mean by the spontaneous symmetry breaking, right? And on the other hand, if you consider, say, if you set G to approach to infinity, then how should you minimize the energy, right? You want to minimize the energy, so because G is infinity, so you may as well just set the ground state to be the eigenstate of poly X operator. Just neglect about the ZZ term. Right. So in this case, ground state is again a product state. So by this I mean it is a spin pointing to the plus poly x direction. Yeah. So right now you see there are two distinctions, right? Because there's a twofold degeneracy here, and there's a unique ground state for the Hamiltonian. So if you try to plot the phase diagram for this model, you find that when g to be zero, this is g to be zero, and this is g equals infinity, and they are separated by some quantum critical point, and some g, finite gc. And this belong to the same phase, where the ground state degeneracy is equal to two. And here, you get a unique ground state. So they cannot be smoothly connected to each other without crossing a gap, right, energy gap. And so that's what we mean by the quantum phase transition. It's a transition in the ground states for Hamiltonian. Yeah. And in particular, we know that there are some other parameters to characterize which phase you are in, right? For example, in this so-called the older phase, you can compute the correlation function between two distance poly spin operator, right? And here you find this guy will scale with an order one. In other words, even though you separate two spins that are far away from each other, they were trying to point along the same direction, right? It is an order one number, it doesn't decay with the separation for any ij. And here, again, it is characterized by the ZZ two-point function. And then here you find that it decays exponentially with the separation between two spins. Yeah. So that's how you characterize this phase diagram, right? So right now, let's try to understand the Turing code under perturbation using these symmetry ideas. Yeah, so right now, let me write down the Turing code Hamiltonian. So the first term and the second term, they compose to this original Turing code Hamiltonian, right? So the first term is the star term. It's the product of four poly Zs on edges. Yeah, so right now, in this Hamiltonian, the qubit live on the edges. And the second term is the product of poly X around the parquet, right? So this is the Hamiltonian we learned just yesterday. And this is the unsigned field acting on the spin, right? And again, the phase diagram is kind of well known. So basically, what you have is that when G to be infinity, then you can just forget about these two terms. And so in order to minimize the energy, you can just set every spin to point along the poly x direction, right? So you get a product state. Yeah, where xi is on this. Yeah. And when g to be zero, we recover the theoretical limit. Yeah. And when you increase g, there's gonna be some critical point that's separating these two phases. So here, for this entire regime, you get the 4-4 degeneracy, right? Ground state degeneracy. And here, you get a unique ground state. All right, so right now, let's try to understand what is the symmetry for this model.
In the Ising case, we are saying that because the number of ground states before GC are 2, the spontaneous symmetry breaking can happen only there. Right? Means you have to choose for spontaneous symmetry breaking, you have to choose one of the ground states.
Right? Yeah. So the important thing is that for this entire regime, mm-hmm. you get a 2-4 degenerate, two different ground states, and they are connected by the global spin flip. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but have we talked about spontaneous symmetry breaking yet?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, so for this entire region, we call that to be the spontaneous symmetry breaking, right?
Yeah.
Spontaneous symmetry breaking happened for this entire region. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. And for this case, because you get a unique ground state, so the symmetry is restored. It is not broken in the ground state. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. All right, so let's try to understand what is the symmetry for this Hamiltonian. So basically, as you can see here, when you add this term, it commutes with this guy, right? Because they are all composed by a product of poly x. So actually, for any g, you find that the Parquet operator still commutes with Hamiltonian, right? For energy, basically, right? Yeah. Because they're all composed by the poly X operator. And So actually, you can imagine the BP operator is a symmetry generator. So in particular, when you draw a lattice, you can say, okay, there's gonna be a symmetry generator, for example. You can choose the unitary, which is the symmetry generator to be a particular product, parquet, right? Which is like this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. So when I draw this, it means it is an operator, which is the product of x, 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 right? And this is a symmetry of Hamiltonian because it commutes with that guy. And of course, because you satisfy this for arbitrary parquets, so when you choose this, you may as well, you are free to deform this loop. Right? So you get a product of x around this loop, and this is still a symmetry for Hamiltonian, right? Yeah. So basically, you just realize that because of this symmetry generator, so as long as the spin form a loop, then that is a symmetry, right? So this is a symmetry for Hamiltonian. It acts on any deformable closed loops, right? And that is a symmetry. And this C is any loops. Yeah. And this is what we call the one-form symmetry. Basically, it means that if you consider, right? So basically, in physics, when we say, okay, there's a Q-form symmetry, in D-dimensional space, the symmetry generator acts on D minus Q. Dimensional space manifold. So in this case, D is equal to 2, right? So if you say, okay, you consider some Q for one form symmetry, then 2 minus 1 is 1, so one form symmetry is an operator acting on any closed loop. It's a one-dimensional object, right? So if you consider Q to be 0, that is a zero form symmetry, so the operator acts on D dimension, which is the global zero symmetry, right? Then that is a conventional Ising symmetry. And so right now, let me try to be more explicit about the definition for Q-form symmetry, which may be useful later.
So Peter, can I ask a question about this? So if I'm looking at electromagnetism, there I have H symmetry and it's a zero form, right? And by these, you mean that I can encapsulate my charges around spheres? That's the...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's the same thing, yeah. Yeah, and more generally, say, let's consider D-dimensional space. And so you consider some closed manifold, D minus Q dimensional space manifold, D minus Q manifold. So in other words, it has the co-dimension one, right? So co-dimension is equal to Q. This object, this manifold has co-dimension Q, so it means that it has a dimension D minus Q. Yeah. And so when you say you have a Q-form G symmetry, that means that there's a corresponding symmetry generator, a unit which is unitary, and labeled by the group element, and it adds on some manifold, D minus Q. Right? So this is the corresponding symmetry generator given by this Q-form symmetry with the group G, right? And in particular, this operator will furnish a representation for the group G. So in other words, right. So basically, you have G and actually label a group element for G. Yeah. So the corresponding unitary operator will satisfy this product rule as well, right? Which is the familiar representation for the group G. Yeah. So basically, if you consider two space dimension with one point symmetry, That means that this manifold for the symmetry generator will be some one-dimensional object. So that's what you see here in the one-form symmetry. And right now, let me try to define the corresponding charge operator. Yeah. So basically, the charge operator will be supported on a Q-dimensional manifold. And this operator will satisfy the following transformation. Yeah, so basically, this equation tells you that you have some operator, some symmetry charges. So that means if you try to transform these symmetry charges under this symmetry action, right, then you get back to itself up to a phase, right? This is what this means. And in particular, this lambda is the one-dimensional representation for G. So for example, if you consider G to be Z2, the phase is just plus or minus one, right? And this number is the intersection between these two manifolds. So this is the manifold for the symmetry action. And this is the manifold for the charges, right? So this is just a definition for the symmetry charges. And and right now, let me try to use the combinatorial for the explanation. So maybe let me use the original 2D ISA model as a example. Right, so and we know that the symmetry generator is given by the product of X on every side. So right here you see that this is a global symmetry. So Q is equal to zero. This is a zero-form global symmetry. And correspondingly, when you consider the charge operator, you should be a zero-dimensional object as well. And which makes sense because you should just choose the single size operator poly Z. And you see that, okay, if you transform this under the global Z2 symmetry, right, you get a minus one sign, right? Because there's a single poly Z here. And if you consider say there are two objects, two poly Z operator, right? And you cannot transform to with a phase which is minus one to the square. Because there are two intersections between the zero dimensional objects and the global manifold, right? So you get minus one to the square, and then Z1, Z2. And you can do the same thing. For example, you can try to transform the Z1, Z2, Z3. And you get minus one to the cubic power. Right? So when you want to measure the symmetry charges for some operator, just count what is the number of intersection about this poly object and the manifold outer space, right? That is what you do for the conventional symmetry charges. And
a simple question. Can you motivate a little bit why we are introducing this manifold language?
Oh, it's just a convenient, I don't know, notation or word to say it's on something in the space, right? Say one dimensional manifold is some line object. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Also, in the general definition, are we assuming all our representations are unitary?
Yeah, we're going to assume the unitary representation. Okay. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's going to be something, at least at this moment, you're going to be something at another state in the Hilbert space, so it's going to be unitary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Right. And I guess another reason I talk about manifold is because you can also discuss the Q-form symmetry, say, in the field theory, right? And there you don't have a lattice, so everything is mostly deformable, so it's natural to consider manifold. Yeah.
Sorry, Peter? Mm-hmm. In a general case, is there also any consistency condition of the action of these charges and symmetries between manifolds, like a relation between like U and manifold? And another one?
Oh, right. So when I write down this condition, it should be correct. It should be true that this relation satisfies for any NQ manifold and the N minus Q manifold. It should be correct for any manifold so that you can call that to be a symmetry charge. Yeah, otherwise, that is a consistency condition. Yeah, right.
Okay, but the action of U on a manifold M and U on a manifold like M prime, different one can be anything. There's no relation between you and actually different M manifolds.
It can be anything. It can be anything. Okay. As long as when you consider this thing, the manifold here should be equal to the. Oh, sorry. I think the only thing is when you consider U G. U H. It cannot be equal to UGH, acting on the same manifold. Yeah, this is the only requirement, and this should be correct for any choice of the manifold. But if you choose a given manifold, then the symmetry generator should satisfy this algebra. Yeah, but then you need to satisfy all the possible choice of the this manifold to be said to, so that it is a Q-form symmetry.
I see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
So,
all right. So,
by then Q form, it's somehow in what subspace that symmetry holds, right? The value Q is just like you have your full manifold in what dimensional subspace?
That's right.
So that's just Q. Okay.
That's right. That's it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so in this case, you have D to be 2, and say you have a Q for, one foreign symmetry. Right, and you just see the generator which is given by the product of X around any loop. And correspondingly, given that definition, you know the charge objects will be one dimension as well. So let me try to draw a lattice. Let me just use that one. Because as you can see here, the operator need to be transformed non-trivially under this symmetry generator. So you may as well just choose the charge operator to be the product of poly Z, right? Because poly Z and poly S, they don't commute. Yeah. So for example, one thing I can do is I can choose, because this is a loop in the original primary lattice, right? I can as well choose a loop. For example, like this. So by this purple curve, I mean it is a part of poly Z's. And it is a dual loop in the dual lattice, right? So for example, it cannot be here, and here, and here, here. Right? So this symmetry operator, this charge operator is a one-dimensional object, right? And locally, it anti-commutes, right? So basically, when you choose a charge operator to be like this, as you can see here, it just counts the number of intersection between this loop, the purple loop, and the original loop given by the symmetry generators, right? And here, they intersect twice. So that means that this guy doesn't carry any charge. It's charge zero. But, and on the other hand, if you can also consider like, okay, so this is the symmetry action given by the product of X around this loop. You can also choose, for example, like a product of Z here, 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 here. So it is an open one-dimensional manifold, and as you can see here, intersects only once, right? So you can say that, okay, so this product of poly Z operator is charged under this symmetry action, right? So it is consistent with the definition that you just count the intersection between the manifold of the symmetry action and the manifold of the charge operator, right? And so the phase is given by the number of intersection between these two manifolds. So, yeah. So if you consider two space dimension, one foreign symmetry, the charge operator is one dimension as well. So right now, one important question is, how do you use this charge operator to characterize different phases, right? As in, like the conventional IC model, you compute like the two-point function, right? And you see what is the behavior for this like a charge correlation function, right? Of course, this guy should appear twice in the global Z2 symmetry, so that because if you consider only this guy, it carries some non-zero charge, so it's gonna be zero. That's why you should not focus on this. And for the IC model case, this is what you should measure, because the charge is equal to zero, so it can take a non-zero position value, and that tells you which phase you are in. And indeed, in the one foreign symmetry, let's consider some closed loop, right? So that it can carry some charge zero. And if you consider that kind of loop, it is the product of Z, right? And what you find is that this guy will behave, so say this is this guy. The product of Z in the dual lattice.
Just
in the first example you gave of icing and the just operator given by the whole product of the xi. When you said q equals zero, was that now for just considering zi as the charge operator, or?
Oh yeah, so there the single set I is a give you a charge operator. It's a zero dimensional object. It's a point like charges, yeah.
Right, so when we then had zi, zj, that was one dimensional. That was q equals one then. Like we considered, you know, three cases, right?
You considered the IC model, right? The original.
Yeah. And then you wrote down three examples.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And that was, first I thought you said all of them were q equals zero, but they were q equals zero, one, and two.
Oh, right. Everything there is q to be zero. So
it was.
Yeah. So in the 2D icing, you get a zero form symmetry given by the product of x, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So far, so good. So the corresponding symmetric charge operator is the zero dimensional object. So for example, you find this relation, right? So a single charge operator will transform non-trivially under this guy. You can pick up minus sign, right? So this is when you insert a single charge operator. You can imagine you can insert two charges, right, at different locations.
Mm-hmm. I'm just confused, like, where exactly the difference arises between the three cases, because right now the q refers to the u that stays the same throughout, and d also stays constant. So how are we changing the number of intersections? Right, like which number refers to the z's? Just definitions.
Let me go slower. Maybe mm-hmm. So you are good with the first condition. Mm-hmm. You have an operator that is charged. It carries a charge underneath a symmetry generator. You also agree with the second condition. It is like in the space, in the 2D space, you have a charge here, say zi. You have another charge here, zj, right? You insert two charges, but they are point-like charges. Mm-hmm. And then the entire object transforms like a minus one to the square. This you also agree. But it is still the global zero form symmetry, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking, well, this now still has q equals zero and d equals two.
That's right, yeah.
So the minus one to the two is?
It's because there are two intersections between the global manifold
okay. And
the zero dimensional line, right?
Right.
You could imagine like you got a 2D space. Then you insert two charges. So one intersection is here, and the other intersection is here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought the number of intersections was like some function of d and q.
It's much more simpler than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you really just count the intersection between two objects. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Intersection between the manifolds. Here is a zero manifold, and the top manifold is just counting on many points. The other case is the intersection between the loops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So basically, as in the conventional IC model, we use the two-point function, you know, to plot which phase you are in, right? Because it carried zero charge, as you can see here. And you use this object to plot which phase you are in. That's like the charge-charge correlation function, right? So we can do a similar thing. If you choose the part of z in the dual lattice, right? It carries zero charge. And again, so you should take some non-zero expression value. And indeed, that is what you'll find. So in this case, in one phase, it decays like this is the so-called parameter law. It decays with the size of the loop, the linear size of the loop. So this is the partial A. So A is the region enclosed by this loop, by this object. And the boundary, the partial A, is basically the length of this loop. So that is what people call the parameter law. Yeah. And in the trivial phase, this object will decay faster, just like the two-point function in IC model will not decay faster, right? Not decay exponentially in the trivial phase. And here, we also find that it decays faster. and that is called area loyalty carry with the area of the of listener loop. Yeah. So again, using this operator, you can prop different phases. So that is one analog to the conventional IC model, the symmetry breaking and symmetry restoring phase. Yeah, so that is one analog. And right now, maybe let me provide a more direct analogy based on the symmetry breaking. So recall, at G to be zero, you get back to the Turing curve, right, without any perturbation. So there, we know one of the ground states is like you sum over all the contractible loops. Right, in the Z basis. So a loop configuration is a product state in the Z basis, right? So that is one of ground states. And as we say here, this is the part of X around the loop is a one-form symmetry generator. And you can also consider the non-contractible loop, and that is the one-form symmetry, right? One-form symmetry include all the closed loop and the non-contractible loops. So for example, you can consider the part of X around a torus, right? This is a symmetry generator in the sense that it commutes with Hamiltonian again. It's the part of X. And however, if you consider the action acting on this ground state, right? You map to a different ground state. Right, this is how we discussed yesterday. So in other words, starting from a ground state, even though the Hamiltonian commutes with this symmetry operator, but this guy will transform non-trivially under this symmetry generation. So it spontaneously break the global this one-form symmetry, right? So this is a natural definition of the symmetry breaking for one-form symmetry, right? And similarly, you can also consider the part of X in the other direction, right? Say WY. And again, you'll find that WY is on the state. Then you don't map to the same state. The state is not invariant under this symmetry action. So again, quite naturally, using this operator, which is a symmetry operator for Hamiltonian, you can generate different ground states. So of course, for a given ground state, you break the symmetry, right? So everything seems to make sense. Yeah, and this feature will carry over to the entire phase diagram up to GC. So it's for this entire phase, you can imagine this you can call that to be the symmetry broken phase of the one-form symmetry. Yeah. Right. Any question for the one-form symmetry or higher form symmetries? Yeah. I don't want to. Question.
So in the case of Turing code, we only break the one-form symmetries along non-contractible loops.
That is also allowed. Yeah, that is also a symmetry. Yeah.
Yes. So, is that general? Like we only spontaneously symmetry break operators on non-contractible or something like that? I think.
Let's see.
Or like, can we? Yeah, spontaneously break you know, a short loop, a contractible loop.
I think the answer should be no. Yeah, you really need a non-contractible loop to map between different ground states. Yeah, but I think it is a collision of the contractible loop and the non-contractible loop that form the one-form symmetry. So when you say one-form symmetry, you already include different objects. Yeah, but indeed you rely on the non-contractible thing to generate a different ground state. Yeah, but I guess people would not say that. Yeah, you can consider the one-form symmetry of a controller loop because it acts trivially based in the ground state subspace, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you really need this loop around the torus to generate. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, coming back to my last question, so in the case of Turing code, yeah, it seems like any Wilson loop, any of these one-form symmetry loops on loops that are deformable to each other are kind of equivalent, right, at least for the ground state.
Right.
So is that a feature of the Tori code, or do we expect this to be for any higher form symmetry?
Oh, I think it's a feature for any higher form symmetry, right? Because if you consider the charge object to be some contractor loop, then that means that there must be some even intersection between this object and the symmetry, right? So it is a, that doesn't rely on any lattice model, right? You agree?
Sure.
If you consider contractor loop for the charge operator, there must be even number of intersection. So, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so that's pretty much all I want to say about a higher form symmetry, but I wanted to make a comment. So the spontaneous breaking of the higher form symmetry can only explain the abelian topological order. So in order to describe the non-abelian topological order, the more general quantum order, you need some more generalized notion for the symmetries. Like in particular, if you want to describe the non-abelian model, you need the so-called fusion categorical symmetry. So in their case, in that case, you don't have the notion for higher form symmetry. So yeah, the higher form symmetry only works for abelian group. So that is a subject we can discuss maybe later. Right. So right now, I want to say a few words about, I want to discuss the topological order from the structure of entanglement. Yeah. So this is a quick review about the entanglement. So recall, say there are only two particles labeled by A and B. Then of course, we suppose that the state for these two particles is a product state in the sense that it is a tensor product of the state in A and the state in B. Oops. Right. So for example, one choice, it could be like psi is equal to, this guy can be chosen to be up and this guy to be chosen to be up. But it doesn't matter as long as it is factorized. Right. Then we say that, okay, there's no entanglement between, then this factorization means there's no entanglement between particle A and B. Roughly speaking, the idea is that if you do some measurement for B, it doesn't affect the state in A because they are factorized. That is the intuition. And on the other hand, if you consider, say, psi to be like, the up up plus the down down, right? It is a Bell pair. When the first particle is in the up state, the second particle must also be in the up state. And similarly for the down state, right? So there are some correlation between these two particles. And in this case, we find the maximal entanglement. And specifically, this is how you compute entanglement, right? Given the state, you may consider the reduced density matrix by tracing out one of the objects. Right. And in this case, if you just do the algebra, you find that this is the state you get. Right. So this is the density matrix that describes the particle A, if you start from the Bell pair, right? So roughly speaking, that means you have a equal probability for A to be in the up state and the down state, right? And how should we understand this phenomena? So basically, roughly speaking, that means that if you neglect the particle B, then you see that there are some fluctuation for particle A, right? Because particle A can right now be in the state up or the down state, right? So then this happens when you neglect the particle B. So when you neglect some part of the system, you find that there are some uncertainty about the remaining system. That means that is the reason why there's an entanglement, right? So entanglement comes from the fluctuation from neglecting one of the party, right? So in order to quantify that, a natural thing to do is to compute the entropy for the reduced density matrix, right? And by definition, this is also equal to this. If you consider a pure state. Yeah. So roughly speaking, the first equation quantify the entropy in the subregion A, right? And this entropy comes from the entanglement between A and B. But similarly, you can as well neglect particle A and you focus on entropy for the region B, right? And because it is a correlation between different parties, so these two should be equal to each other if you consider a pure state, right? Yeah, so basic entropy, this is called what we call entanglement entropy. So basically, entropy of an object quantify the uncertainty and the fluctuation about the object, right? And if that uncertainty comes from the fact that when you neglect one party, then that is what we call the entanglement entropy, right? Because so entanglement can be quantified as fluctuation for a subregion, which is the natural definition. Right, so. And practically speaking, one way to compute entanglement entropy is that given some state, you may want to compute the reduced density matrix for the region A, right? And if you consider the density matrix, you can try to diagonalize the density matrix. So right now, I is some pure state. So this is like, it is an ensemble of this pure state. And the P is some probability corresponding to some particular pure state. And in this case, you know that entropy is just equal to this guy minus sum over pi log pi, so which is the classical Shannon entropy, right? And this is how you quantify the uncertainty for objects, right? Yeah. And the one feature about entanglement is that there's an upper bound. For entanglement. So entanglement entropy for a subregion will be bounded by the log reason. Of the Hilbert dimension for the one of the party, right? And for example, if you consider qubits, then this guy is equal to a log reason of 2 to the NA. Yeah, so particle, say the subregion A or the party A, they are composed by NA number of particle, NA number of qubits. So the Hilbert dimension is the 2 to the NA, and this guy is equal to NA log 2. Yeah, so entanglement entropy is always bounded by this guy. And it saturates whenever rho A is equal to one over the identity divided by the dimension of the Hilbert space in the region A, right? And the reason being is like, if you consider this kind of density matrix, it is like, it is as maximally uncertain as you can be, right? So in this case, we say that A is maximally entangled with the counterpart, which is the part B. And right now, let's focus on the entanglement structure for many body systems. So say you have n qubits. So the total Hill principle dimension is like is equal to 2 to the n. Yeah. And so right now I didn't assign the spatial locality for the system, but you may as well just choose randomly. Like there are n a number of qubits here, and there are n b number of qubits here. With NA plus NB to be equal to N. So here we can ask, what is the entanglement between A and B? So for example, if you pick a random state in the Hilbert space, so basically the statement is that if you consider this entire Hilbert square, there are so many possible states. So if I can ask, if I just randomly pick a state, like uniformly in the entire Hilbert space, then I can get a precise state, right, which is a pure state, based on some random measure, right, in the entire Hilbert space. I can ask, what is the entanglement between A and B in this random pure state, right? That is a valid question to ask. So in that case, you find that, for example, if you consider NA is less than NB, then you find out that entanglement entropy between A and B was scaled with the volume or the number of qubits in the subregion A, right? Or if you want to plot a curve like this, so this is the fraction. This is the NA divided by the total number of qubits. Then if you plot a curve like this, you find that, okay, there's a 1/2, it is 1. So here, because of this condition for NA over N less than 1/2, you find that it increased linearly with the number of qubits, right, in the region A. But then here, you should count down, because A and B are symmetric to each other, right? So this is the typical behavior for entanglement entropy for random state in the Hilbert space. This is what you should expect. So by this, we mean entanglement satisfies the so-called volume law, because the entanglement grows with the volume or the number of qubits in the subregion, right? But on the other hand, that is the situation for a typical random state. But if you consider the ground state of a many-body local Hamiltonian, the situation is very different. Yeah, say I consider some lattice with some qubits. I can imagine I write down some local Hamiltonian with some local operator, right? So x is some location in the space. And this Ox is the operator acting around this location x. It's a sum of local terms, it's a local Hamiltonian, right? And what we find is that if you divide the entire system into two parts, say A and B, then in D-dimensional Hilbert space, in D-dimensional space, the real space, what you find is that if you consider the ground state and then you compute the entanglement between A and B, what you find is that A will scale with the boundary size of the region A. Yeah. So it doesn't scale with the number of qubits in the region A, but instead, the scale is the boundary size of the region A. Or if you like, you can write down like LA to the D minus 1, where D is the space dimension, and LA is the characteristic size for the region for the region A. Yeah. So the structure for entanglement for the many body graphs is very different from a typical state in the entire Hilbert space. That is one thing you should keep in mind. And so this is what we call the area law. And this is in contrast to the volume law for a typical pure state in the Hilbert space, if you just choose randomly. Yeah. And right now, let's specialize to the situation where you have two space dimensions.
Peter, this area law is for any many-body system. Doesn't need to have topological order.
Oh, you mean this?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't need to be. It's the any for any system in any d-dimensional space. And it's the ground state of a many-body Hamiltonian. Yeah, thanks.
So in this case, we are saying we just have n qubits. And means what is the difference between...
Right. So in this case, there are n number of qubits, and I can divide those qubits into two parts labeled by A and B. Mm-hmm. And right now, I don't specify the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
I just randomly pick a state in the Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
I ask what is the typical amount of entanglement for that pure state.
I see.
And that scale with the number of qubits, and that is very different from the ground state of a many-body local Hamiltonian.
But so, here also there would be say n qubits, but you are specifying a local Hamiltonian.
Yeah, right now say I can also consider n qubits.
Yeah.
But I divide these two systems with some boundaries.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So there's a locality in the space.
Nice. So here it's just any random state we pick from the full Hilbert space. Here we are saying we are picking are we picking ground states all? I don't know what is the difference here.
Right. So that would be the ground state. Yeah. So in some lattice, in d-dimensional system, right? Mm-hmm. I can write down the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And I consider the ground states.
Yeah. So we consider only the ground state. And
only the ground state. And this is what people believe. Yeah. Okay. There are certain cases where you can violate this, but it's generically correct. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right, so right now let me specialize to d equals 2. Yeah, and the size of this guy, the characteristic size, linear size, is LA for the subregion. And what people found. So this is a universal scaling form. Let me write down this. So if you consider the ground state, which has some topological order, right?
Can you explain what you mean by many body in the Hamiltonian you wrote?
Many body just mean there are many qubits in the system.
But there are no inter-site interaction.
Oh, there could be some inter-site interaction. So say every spin lives on the vertices. And when I write down local term, it specifies the interaction between qubits in the sense that it is supported around this region. There's a label by X, the coordinate. And all X has a support around this region. And this operator specifies the interaction between the qubits and round.
Sorry, what is X label?
X label the space coordinate. The lattice coordinate, like.
So it's one lattice site.
X is some one lattice site, yeah. But then you can have operator supporting around that one lattice site.
So the support can contain multiple sites.
That's right. And okay, you need to contain multiple sites so that you can assign the interaction.
Yeah, that's what many body means. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
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 Sorry, the notation is just a little bit confusing.
Yeah, sure, yeah. But the many-body local Hamiltonian people typically means this. It's a sum of some local operator, where local operator can be you know, can concentrate at a lot of different sites, but it is supported by supported on some multi-site region.
Right, and it's finite support, right?
It's finite size, yeah.
Yeah. What yeah. about the Coulomb?
Hmm?
The case of the Coulomb gas, for example, the Coulomb interaction is infinite.
Then in that case, you have some long-range interaction, so you can violate this area low entanglement. Yeah. Yeah.
And the result about area law entanglement, is that more an extrapolation from looking at various specific cases of such Hamiltonians, or is it an analytical result?
We don't have any analytical results. So it is, when we say law in physics, but right now it is actually kind of empirical. So basically for typical Hamiltonian, you can write down an Ising model, any topological order Hamiltonian, you can write down. Then people find that you satisfy this area law entanglement. We don't have a proof. We only have a proof in 1D. In 1D, you can prove that if there's an energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state, then the ground state will satisfy the area law entanglement. There's a proof in 1D, but there's no proof in higher dimension. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it is basically satisfied for many familiar with Hamiltonian you can write down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And are people trying to prove something like this? Because I know, like, Roger, right, does a lot of simulations on specific prefactors, but...
Sure. But if you want to say you want to have a general proof, I think people try to make some progress, and there are some... you need to assume certain more condition. Like, if you assume the exponential decay for the two-point function, then you can prove this area low. Mm-hmm. But in general, if you're just writing down the local Hamiltonian itself, you cannot prove it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. All right, so now let me specialize to two space dimension and say I write down a ground state. And if this guy has some topological order, say, for example, the ground state of a 2D torical we just discussed, or when you perturb the torical but in the same phase, so it has some topological order, then what people find is that SA can be written by this scaling form. Yeah, so this is a scaling form. So the leading order term is the area low piece, right? So you can consider some 2D. So the leading piece basically say that if proportional entanglement between A and B scale with the size, the boundary size of A, right? So that means that the first term basically means that there are some short-range entanglements around the boundary between A and B. And the second term is what's more interesting. So when you find the topological order ground state, this gamma will be some order one number. And it is non-zero. So, and the other term will vanish if you try to scale up the systems. Yeah. But this non-zero gamma is the what is more interesting. So by this, the gamma is typically called a topological entanglement entropy. So basically, if you consider some trivial state, say a shorter entangled state, what you find is gamma to be zero. But if you are in the topological order phase, the ground state has some topological order, then people find that you have some subleading term, which is order one, and this is some positive number. And that quantifies some long-range entanglement with a reason we'll see very soon. And this is introduced by this idea of topological entanglement is introduced by Kitayev. Prescale. So it's a paper in 2006. And at the same time, there's a different group of people by Levin and Wang. Also in the same year. Yeah, if you're interested, you can find more details in these two papers. Yeah. So one application is that it is a, you can imagine the gamma is like a order parameter to diagnose whether you have order or not, right? So for example, as we see before, if you try to perturb the Turing code, so when g equals zero, there's no perturbation, it's the perfect Turing code. And this entire region belongs to the same phase. And here, gamma is equal to log two. So it is a non-zero constant, and it is a universal constant. It is a property of the phase. That's the important part. And if you go across the quantum critical point, you find that gamma to be equal to zero. Yeah, so gamma is a very useful thing to diagnose whether you have order or not. Right, so let me provide more examples. So if you consider Z2 topological orders, the subregion entanglement entropy will basically like this. The leading order area little piece subtracted by the universal constant log two plus dot dot dot, which will vanish in thermodynamic limit. And this alpha is non-universal. It means that when you vary this coupling constant G, right? Although they belong to the same phase, when you vary G, this preferred alpha will change continuously. So there's nothing special about this preferred alpha, which makes sense because this the first term will scale with the boundary size, right? So the first term will capture some short range entanglement around the boundaries, and that is not a universal property of the phase. That is the way you should think about this. And if you consider a 2D Turing code, you find gamma to be log two, and there's a reason why. Say you choose this kind of boundary, right? This is the subregion A. And as we know, roughly speaking, the ground state is the sum of all the loop. So it is a superposition of massive loop configuration where, for example, for a given snapshot, you can imagine there's a loop like this, right? Yeah, and what you find is that there must be, when there's a loop, this loop will cut through this boundary. But then you're gonna penetrate through this boundary of A, right? So in other words, because it is a sum of loops, when you consider this boundary, there must be even number of intersection between the boundary and the allowed loop configuration, right? So that means when you write down the state, there must be even number of spin down. Around the boundary. And it is a global property of this, it is a global property, right? Because it only demands that there are even number of intersection. So it is a global property and it is a global constraint. And because you know that there must be even number of spin down around the boundaries, so it is a global reduction. So you can decrease one piece of entropy, right? Because you know more, right? This is the global knowledge you have. So you know more, so you decrease the entropy, you decrease the uncertainty, and that piece will go into this log two. So that's kind of the reason why you can see this subleading the global reduction is kind of like a universal property of the phase. So that's one way to think about this. And in the problem set, I design a homework where you consider Turing code and you can really sit down to do calculation, and you find this gamma to be log two. It's a simple calculation you can do. And more generally, this gamma, because the topological order system can be understood as some corresponding TQFT, the so-called topological quantum field theories, and there you can really derive that this gamma will depend on some anion data for this underlying TQFT, but I won't mention that here. So what I want to do is I want to provide more intuition about this subrelated term gamma.
Peter, could you repeat what were the loops you were drawing that were intersecting A?
Oh, right. So basically, you choose a subregion A here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know that the ground state is the sum of all the possible loops.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, locally, every spin, you can imagine there's a local spin, right? This mm-hmm. spin can be pointing up or pointing down.
Yeah.
Because you don't know whether it belongs a loop or not, right? But you find that when you try to draw some corresponding loop configuration, this is the typical loop configuration, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even though you don't know whether each spin is pointing up or pointing down, but you know that around the boundary, there must be even number of spin down, that's right. So that is the global knowledge you have, even though you don't know individually whether it's spin up or spin down, but you know that there must be even number of spin down. So that's why you can reduce the entropy.
No, but why do we know that there are even number of spin downs? You're saying every time it intersects?
Every time when it intersects, right? Because the loop, when I draw a loop, that means every spin is pointing down around the loop.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's an even number intersection between the loop and the boundaries. So you know some global knowledge about the spin configuration around the boundary.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why you get a subleading subtraction. Yeah. Thanks for the questions. And one interesting perspective I want to discuss is you can imagine this gamma is an abstraction. To transform a topological order state to trivial product state. For example, every spin is pointing up, which is a trivial state. Yeah. So basically, the idea is that, as we know, so basically, when you are in the same phase, you can imagine you can adiabatically tune the parameter in the Hamiltonian, right? And that corresponding to some finite time unitary dynamics. Maybe let me forget about the details. But so when you tune the parameter G, as long as they are in the same phase, they can be connected by some finite time unitary evolution given by some local Hamiltonian, right? Or you can imagine quantum circuit if you like. Yeah. And on the other hand, if you want to tune the unitary such that you can so when this alpha can continuously decrease when you want to tune across this critical point, right? But eventually you want to tune the alpha so that alpha is equal to zero, right? Because that is what you want to do, you want to trivialize the state, right? But this is not allowed because when you want to continuously tune the parameter so such that you can tune alpha to be zero, but this is not allowed because then you find that SA will be equal to minus gamma, right? Which is negative. But this is impossible because we know entropy must be positive. So it means that this minus gamma is an abstraction so that you cannot continuously tune from the topological order phase to a trivial state, right? So that's why you need to get a minus sign. So that's one way to think about it. So finally, let me provide the one last intuition I want to mention. That is, when you write down this kind of scaling form, why gamma must be universal? There are some simple reasons to see why it must be universal. So, and it is an argument from the symmetry of entanglement, which I will explain right now. So it can be found in this archive reference. Yeah. So basically, the intuition is that if you consider some gapped trivial state, or in other words, it is some short-range entangled state. That means when you divide the system into two parts, you can imagine that in the coarse-grained level, you could imagine the entanglement entropy will come from the boundary, right? So you can imagine you divide the boundary into many different patches labeled by I. And this Si is like a local contribution about the entanglement between the A and B around this patch, right? So yeah, roughly speaking, it is the, yeah, so it's an entanglement contribution for around this small patch I. And if you're trying to cross-grain, you could imagine it is an integral around a boundary. And here you put some like an entropy function, which depends on some data, for example, like the curvature or the derivative of the curvature or high order terms, right? It's kind of motivated by, you know, how do you write down the Ginzburg-Landau free energy? You just try to guess based on some symmetry argument. And right now the idea is that we are trying to guess the functional form for this F function. So and kappa is the curvature. For that small patch. And the first thing you notice is that there are some symmetry aspects that can constrain this function. So the first thing we notice is that we know the entanglement is invariant, you know, under exchange of A and B, right? So SA is equal to SB. This is the first property of the defining property of entanglement entropy, right? So that means when you try to expand this F function, yeah, it's a function of some curvature and A is some non-universal coefficient. And this function should also be invariant under exchange of A and B. And you know that when you exchange A and B, it is like, let's see. Say this is a boundary, and this is A, this is B. Locally, you have this guy, right? So when you exchange the role between A and B, when you exchange A and B, you flip the sign of the curvature, right? Because the inner side will become the outer side if you do the exchange between A and B. Yeah. And on the other hand, we know that entanglement should be invariant. The local entanglement contribution should also be invariant under exchange of between A and B, right? So that immediately implies all the R term in K in the curvature cover should vanish. So that the entire entanglement can be invariant under the exchange of between A and B. Yeah, so every R term in kappa should vanish. So basically the first term will give you like, right, because this is it has the units of length. So it's just alpha zero times the size of the boundary size LA. And the second term, because the curvature is like curvature is like 1 over L, right, in terms of units. And when you consider kappa squared, you get 1 over L squared, and you multiply by the length. So basically, you're going to get something like 1 over L, LA. And all the higher order terms in kappa will decay when you increase the size of LA, right? Yeah, so all this guy will try to, you know, vanish when you scale up the entire systems. So this is what you'll find. So in other words, if you consider on general ground based on symmetry arguments, you find that there's no order one constant that is allowed when you consider this local curvature expansion, right? It doesn't appear. So that means when you consider some, when you have some scaling form like this, where gamma is some order one constant, doesn't decay with certain size, then that means that that is not captured by this sum of contribution of local entanglements. So it must be some long range entanglement. And so this is the intuition why that gamma may not show up in this short range entanglement expansion. So that is one interesting aspect that I think is useful. Yeah, so finally, yeah, let me use one minute to say something that I think is interesting. So there's a paper by Isaac King. Here's the reference.
Peter, could you briefly say why that curvature expansion is only possible for short-range entangled states?
Oh, for which space, sorry?
You said short-range entangled.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Because this, when I write down this, it basically means that I'm going to sum over different patches labeled by A, by I, with this guy, right? And this guy is like the local entanglement, say, between around this patch between A and B. So it's just a cross-grain level where this entropy function can be written as some curvature dependence functional. And the sum over I, when you sum over different patches, this is like you are doing some integral around this boundary, right? So it's just, this is the discretized version, and this is a continuous version, if you like. Yeah. And just from the general ground, you can imagine this local entropy density should depends on the curvature and some coefficients. So, but it's a general thing you can write down. Yeah. This is a reference by Isaac King in 2013. So there's an important statement where if you consider some topological order system where, and you find this in a general relation. Yeah, so NG is the number of locally indistinguishable states on a torus. Yeah, so basically this is the number of ground states. And as we know in the Turing curve, right, we know that say on a torus, the number of ground states will be bigger than one, right? Which is a defining feature about topological order state. And based on this relation, you know that the corresponding gamma must be greater than zero. Must be greater than zero. Yeah. So this is a very, very good result in the sense that it just tells you if I have some indistinguishable ground states on some space manifold, that automatically implies a lower bound for gamma. So in this case, gamma will be some positive order one constant. So it is, which is a universal bound. So this is a different aspect where, you know, gamma mass exists. Yeah, and this long-range entangled mass exists. Yeah, so that's pretty much I want to say in the second lecture, so thank you so much.
Peter, for this really nice lecture. Enjoyed it. Are there more questions?
There's a question.
Yeah, just going back to the phase diagram that you drew on the right.
Right.
Yeah, with so let's say I'm in the Tor code and I insert a perturbation that condenses out like the electric lines, let's say, right? And then I tune this perturbation. And similarly, I'm going to get a phase diagram of that form. But what if I added, so I can do the same with the magnetic line because the,
and
I'll get the same thing. But what if, right, I tune them at the same time, like at the same rate, so the phase diagram, I go like this.
Right, that's right,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, yeah, just repeat a question. So you can consider the toric code, and there are two kinds of perturbation. For example, you can add this on-site term. And you can also ask. You can also allow to add this kind of term. So indeed, you get a two-dimensional phase diagram. And so to say this is GZ, and this is GX. So there's gonna be some, so this is a torical phase, and there are gonna be some region where the entire system is a torical Z2 topological order. And here you find the gamma to be log two for in this entire phase. Yeah, so it doesn't matter what kind of perturbation you add, it's a property of the phase. And throughout this region, gamma to be is equal to zero. Yeah, and this is a thing people numerically verify as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I think I've heard somewhere, I don't understand this very well, but I think I've heard somewhere that there's actually a phase boundary along the diagonal.
Right, yeah. So yeah, there are some, I think there are some paper last year. So what happened around this boundary is an open question, actually.
Oh, OK.
Yeah, whether it's a second order or the weakly first order, I think that people haven't settled down yet.
OK.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have one more question, again, about the kind of the motivation for the Q-form formalism.
Right.
Because at the end of that section, you introduced the perimeter law and the area law and the phase diagram.
Right.
So I'm not sure whether, you know, these geometric objects and talking about manifolds in areas, et cetera, helps us derive that relationship.
That's right. It doesn't help you to derive the relationship, but it helps you to understand what kind of object you are looking for mm-hmm. as an order parameter. Mm-hmm. For example, in a global Eisen symmetry, you need to look for the ZZ tumor function because the single Z is a carries some charge. So it's gonna vanish, right, in the ground state. So you need to look for the charge-charge correlation function, and that can pop, that serves as an order parameter. And given this one-form symmetry analogy, the object you should look for is some loop-like object. Mm-hmm. And that can be an order parameter, yeah.
And that's what you meant with it's not enough for non-abelian models. Like there, that formalism does not help you find the order parameter.
For non-abelian model.
Yeah, for non-abelian models, it doesn't help you find the order parameter. That's the problem. Why you need extra stuff.
Oh, I think the problem is if you consider non-abelian model, then you don't have the higher form symmetry to begin with. Higher form symmetry only works for abelian group. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the reason, roughly, is that the consistency conditions are so strong that in the non-abelian case, there are...
That's right. And maybe I can... That's right. Maybe there's a simple way to understand this. Yeah, so indeed, as Aldo mentioned, there's some consistent condition, right? So you can imagine this is the 2D space. This is the space, the 2D space. And this is time. And say you consider some symmetry action. which is the loop in the space. Say this is UG. And you can also consider like, say this adds on the time slice where T is labeled by T, the time axis. You can imagine in the T plus epsilon time, you add on another symmetry action labeled by G, H, the symmetry group, sorry, the group element G, H. Then, so it is slightly above this guy, right? But then because it is a loop, so you can imagine the order doesn't matter, right? Because you can continuously deform the loop above to be bigger, and then you can exchange the order between these two loop symmetry action. So as you can see here, the order doesn't matter because the loop is deformable. So I guess that's the reason why it must be abelian symmetry action. Yeah.
Whereas in the case of zero symmetry, you are on the whole space, so you cannot cross it.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it for this morning. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And have a good weekend.